John 1:34-2:22, the second talk in a series entitled The Gospel of John, was presented by Ron Julian on June 29, 2008 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2008. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Tight central focus to the Gospel of John. There is a purpose that has determined what he's choosing to present and the stories that he's telling in the Gospel. And I would say that tight focus is the problem of belief. The fundamental assertion in the book of John is this: eternal life comes to those who believe the testimony that Jesus is the Christ. But there are a whole set of issues and problems associated with this idea of belief, and the Gospel of John is exploring those issues, I would argue. Today we're going to look at three stories that involve the disciples of Jesus. Because the Gospel of John is all about testimony and belief and the relationship between them, the disciples play a very important part. First of all, the disciples are the ones who see the evidence that Jesus is the Christ. Secondly, the disciples respond themselves. They are a model of people who respond to this evidence with belief. And then it is their testimony, ultimately, that you and I are called on to believe. We're not seeing these things happen. It's their testimony that these things happened that we're responding to. So we need to know who they are and that they're reliable. And so the disciples play a big role in the Gospel of John, not just because historically they happen to be around, but because of this role that they play for us. Now, I want to warn you what I'm doing here today. This is a little different for me. I tend to be a let's go along and explain each detail as we go kind of person. But today, I want to look at three stories. And in order to do that, I'm going to take a sort of a general overview approach. There are a number of things that we could say about these stories, a number of details that we could stop and explain, a number of issues that we could draw out and explore. But I think that these stories are tied together with a common theme, and my purpose this morning is to bring that theme out. In order to do that, we're going to go through all three stories, and I'm going to let some of the details fall to the side. But that means that you're in a position when we get to the end and time for questions that you can explore any of those issues that you want. Any of those details that I didn't talk about, feel free to bring up. Okay, so our first story starts in chapter 1, verse 35. This is the story of how the first of the disciples come to meet and believe in Jesus. Again, the next day, John was standing with two of his disciples, and he saw Jesus walking and said, "Look, the Lamb of God." And I should mention, by the way, this is John the Baptist that was to John there. And the two disciples heard what John said, and so they followed after Jesus. But Jesus turned and noticed that they were following him, so he said, "What do you seek?" And they said to him, "Rabbi," which translated means teacher, "where are you staying?" He said to them, "Come and see." So they came and saw where he was staying, and they stayed with him that day, since it was about the 10th hour. One of the two who had heard John speak and so followed Jesus was Andrew, Simon Peter's brother. First, he went to find his own brother, Simon, and said to him, "We have found the Messiah," which translated means Christ. He brought him to Jesus. Jesus looked at him and said, "You are Simon, the son of John. You shall be called Cephas," which is translated Peter. The next day, he decided to leave for Galilee, and he found Philip. And Jesus said to him, "Follow me." Now Philip was from Bethsaida, the city of Andrew and Peter. Philip found Nathanael and said to him, "We have found him of whom Moses wrote in the law and of whom the prophets wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph. I'm going to stop there for a second. Okay, so this first story begins the day after John the Baptist gave his testimony concerning Jesus, and we talked about that last week. God told John that the Spirit would descend as a dove upon the one who was the chosen one, the Messiah. And John testifies that he saw that happen. I saw that happen to Jesus, that guy there. So I'm here to testify that this is the Messiah. What we're seeing now are kind of the ripples that are going out from John's testimony. So we start with Andrew and one other person who are both disciples of John the Baptist. The second disciple is not named. Many suspect that it is actually John, the author of the gospel, because he has a habit of not mentioning himself by name in the book. So either he just doesn't bother to mention who this is, or in fact it was John and he doesn't say so. John the Baptist had been their rabbi, and they are his disciples, his students. He had been their teacher. They follow him where he goes, listening to his teaching. They believe him when he says that he's a prophet from God, and they have believed him, presumably, when he said that the Messiah was coming. And now he's said to them, that guy, that's the one. I've been saying he's coming, that's him. So on the basis of John the Baptist's testimony, they follow after Jesus. Jesus' invitation to join him where he is staying has implications to it. It's really the start of a new phase of their lives. The whole idea of being the disciple of a rabbi was you would go and stay with him and follow him around and learn from him and be taught from him as he was doing the things of his life. And that's what's going to happen here with Andrew and this other disciple. They're going to stay with Jesus, and ultimately they're going to follow him, and he's going to be their rabbi. Now, Andrew is clearly buying this. He goes to his brother Simon and says, "We have found the Messiah." And at this point, all he really has to go on is John the Baptist's testimony and a little time spent hanging around with Jesus. But basically, he's heard John, and he's convinced. John says, "This is the Messiah. I'd better go tell my brother. This is the Messiah that we found." So, at that point then, Andrew's brother Simon joins in. Presumably he's there because of what his brother Andrew has told him, and that primarily has to be what John the Baptist had told Andrew, that this is the Messiah. So Simon goes to meet Jesus, and Jesus gives him a new name. He calls him Rock. It doesn't come out in our translation, but that's Kephas is the Aramaic name, the word that means rock, and Petros is the Greek, the masculine form of the word that means rock. So Peter means rock. And you'll notice we could have, in our translation, if we wanted to, we could have actually translated it. Up above, he said, Rabbi, that means teacher. Here, he called him Kephas, or most people say it Cephas because that's what it looks like. We could have translated it, which means rock, because that's what it means. So Peter's name is Rock, and we could call him Rock if we wanted to, because that's what his name is. But we chickened out and decided to just treat it as a name. Okay, so now he's got a new name, Peter, Rock. Next comes Philip. What does Philip have to go on? Well, he has the person of Jesus in front of him, but mostly what he's got is here's this rabbi, and he has a couple of disciples, and what's their story? Their story is that John the Baptist, the prophet, announced that this is Jesus, the Messiah. And we know that Philip believed this because he goes and tells Nathanael, "We have found the one that Moses and the prophets wrote about." That is the Messiah. We have found the Messiah. So in the story so far, we don't know really anything about what Jesus has said or done that would convince them that he's the Messiah. Maybe he hasn't done anything. I mean, he's just been kind of a cool guy to hang around with, and I think I can learn something from him. But we have all of these people convinced that he's the Messiah, and the main evidence that we have so far is the testimony of John the Baptist, that that's who this is. Now, Philip, though, has gone to Nathanael. And here we see the influence of testimony starts to break down, because Nathanael has this problem. And we'll start reading back in verse 45. Philip found Nathanael and said to him, "We have found him of whom Moses wrote in the law, and of whom the prophets wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph." And Nathanael said to him, "Can anything good come from Nazareth?" Philip said to him, "Come and see." Jesus saw Nathanael coming to him and said of him, "Now here is an Israelite indeed, in whom there is no guile." Nathanael said to him, "How do you know me?" Jesus answered, "Before Philip called you, when you were under the fig tree, I saw you." Nathanael answered him, "Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel." Jesus replied, "Because I said that I saw you under the fig tree, do you believe? You're going to see greater things than that." He said to him, "Truly, truly, I say to all of you, you shall see the heavens opened and the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man." Okay, so Philip testifies to his friend Nathanael, to his belief that Jesus is the Christ. But he tells him who he is, Jesus of Nazareth. And Nathanael has this problem. Nazareth? You got to be kidding me. Nazareth? I mean, Bible doesn't say anything about Nazareth. I mean, what about Bethlehem or Jerusalem or some of these hot kind of places? And anyway, Nazareth, it's this little hole in the wall place. Nathanael himself is from Galilee. He knows Nazareth. I mean, it's that little dump village over there. So he's suspicious about this. This doesn't sound likely to me. And he says so bluntly. Philip says, "Well, come and see. You won't buy my testimony? All right, you come and see for yourself." Which is, again, a theme that's very relevant in the Gospel of John. Why would I believe this? Well, come and check it out. As Nathanael approaches, Jesus says something that obviously blows him away. Now, I've heard various discussions about exactly what it is that Jesus says here, what it is that he's getting at and what this is about. It is a little cryptic. Let me just tell you what I think is happening, what makes sense to me in this story. What Jesus says to Nathanael, I think, is intended to be a comment on what Nathanael had just said to Philip. Nathanael had just responded to his friend's enthusiasm with this blunt, "Can anything good come from Nazareth?" Jesus says to him, about him, "Now here is an Israelite indeed in whom there is no guile." That is, I think he's saying basically, now here's a real Israelite for you. He tells you just what he's thinking. Okay. He doesn't use guile or sneakiness. If he thinks you're wrong, he just says so. Which is exactly how Nathanael had responded to Philip. So I think Jesus' statement is not just a general sort of, "Oh, here comes a good guy." What he's saying is a comment on what Nathanael had just said, and Jesus wasn't there. So Nathanael wonders, "How do you know me?" I think he might recognize, "Yeah, that kind of sounds like me." But how would you know that that's the case? And then Jesus makes it clear that he saw the whole episode with Philip. Before Philip even arrived, Jesus saw Nathanael sitting there. And he saw Philip call to him, and presumably he heard how Nathanael responded. And that is what has brought about this comment that he makes, an Israelite without guile. So basically, this is a minor miracle that Jesus has done for Nathanael's benefit. I wasn't anywhere near the place, but I'll tell you exactly what happened. And that's what Nathanael responds to. This is amazing. I mean, you tell me that this is the Messiah. Yeah, he's from Nazareth. I don't know that I'm going to buy that. But I show up, and he's telling me what I was saying and doing when he wasn't even there. So he responds with belief. He believes this statement that Philip had made before, which he greeted with suspicion, that this is the Messiah, now he buys it. He agrees. And that's what this means, I think, when he says, "You are the Son of God, you are the King of Israel." This, I talked a little bit about this last time, but I would argue that Son of God and King of Israel are both two different ways of saying this is the Messiah. Messiah means anointed one. The King of Israel was anointed. The King of Israel was referred to as the Messiah, the anointed one. Now they're waiting for the king with a capital K who's going to come and bring in the kingdom of God. But he's still the king of Israel. He's still the anointed one, the Messiah. And he's also the son of God, which is another phrase that came to be used to refer to the Messiah. Notice that Nathanael, I mean, all he's heard is, this is the guy Moses and the prophets were talking about. That's what he's heard. He comes and he becomes convinced of that, and he says, you're the son of God. So this is, again, another piece of evidence that the son of God is a phrase that they were familiar with. This is a phrase that referred to the Messiah, which is what I would argue. Okay. So we see Nathanael using these two common titles for the Messiah, King of Israel, Son of God. He believes it. All of a sudden, he's switched. I'm not suspicious anymore. This is him. In the context of John, Jesus' response to him is very significant, I think, because of the theme of the book. Because I said that I saw you under the fig tree, do you believe? Jesus is saying, oh, that's what did it, huh? The fact that I said that I saw you. That's why you believe it now. John's gospel is all about believing in Christ and why we believe in Christ and what that belief ultimately involves. So Jesus' question is an interesting one at that spot. Oh, so that's why you believe, huh? It's interesting that this exact same thing happens at the end of John with, in a way, a similar kind of story with who we refer to as doubting Thomas. Thomas is told that Jesus has risen from the dead, and he says, I don't buy this. Unless I see it, I'm not going to believe it. Then he sees it. Jesus comes to him, and he believes. And Jesus says exactly the same thing. Oh, that's why you believe, huh? Okay, that question, so what is it exactly that is going to take to make you believe? That's a central question in the book. Well, in this case, there's an explicit answer in the text to that question. Jesus is saying, do you believe because of this little striking display of God's power that I've done? You're going to see much greater things than these. So at least part of Jesus' response is, well, yeah, I understand that this is impressive to you, but you ain't seen nothing yet, is what he's basically saying. But in the context of John, I think that there's at least a little bit of a hint of something else here, because this theme shows up so much in the letter, that asking the question, what really fundamentally is the basis of your belief? You say you believe that I'm the Messiah, and that's what it took? You believe it because of that? Well, it would be worthwhile to stop and think about, what is it you really believe, and why do you believe it here? I think Jesus wants Nathanael to ask himself why he is believing this, because in John, this issue shows up a lot. Believing in Christ is a spiritual issue. Being confronted with evidence is not really enough. There is an internal battle that happens in becoming a person of faith, a person who believes this story. And the evidence is important, but even more important is the spiritual state of the one who receives the evidence. So I think Jesus is just asking Nathanael to slow down and stop for a second and think, okay, so what? Why? This is why you believe this? Okay. And let's think about that a little bit. Perhaps not, but I can certainly say that that kind of thinking is going to show up a lot in the book as we go along. But Jesus does say, you will see greater things than this. All of you will see the heavens opened and the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man. Son of Man is another messianic title, I would argue. Jesus refers to himself that way a lot. It's likely here that Jesus is alluding to the famous story of Jacob's ladder, where in the Old Testament, Jacob has a dream. He's sleeping out in this place, and he has a dream where God tells him that his family will inherit the land that he's sleeping on. But in this dream, he looks up and he sees God in heaven, and there is a ladder going from heaven to earth, and there are angels ascending and descending on the ladder. So I think Jesus is kind of alluding to that. The angels are ascending and descending, doing the work of God, coming down to do God's work, going back to God to get further instructions, you know, that sort of thing. But so one day the disciples are going to see Jesus as the focus of all of this heavenly activity. He is the one on whom the angels, some people try to say that he's the ladder. They're going up and down on him. I don't think that's what he means at all. He's just saying that instead of picturing Jacob down here, now we have Jesus, who is the place the angels are ascending and descending, coming to him. And what's the significance of this? Some commentators are inclined to take this metaphorically. The focus of the heavenly activity is going to be in my ministry. So as you see me doing things and doing miracles and preaching and stuff, this is watching, quote, the angels ascending and descending on me. And that's possible, I guess. I'm inclined to take it literally, that I think Jesus is talking about his ultimate revelation as the Messiah, which is often described in terms of him coming with his angels and all of that sort of stuff. So I think what he's saying is, you are going to see an open display. The heavens will open, the angels of God ascending and descending on me. You know, this little miracle that you just saw now is nothing compared to what you will see one day, I think is what he's getting at. But either way, he's saying there's a lot more to come. Okay, so in this little section where we see the disciples here, we see several disciples coming to believe that Jesus is the Messiah, at least enough to follow him. They have decided to vote yes on the question, is Jesus the Messiah? And that belief is fundamentally based on the testimony of John the Baptist, and then it has been buttressed, it has been reinforced with this little miracle that Jesus does for Nathanael's sake. Okay, so at this point, we have a number of men who have decided that Jesus is the Christ based on some testimony of John and this event with Nathanael. Okay. Lots of things we could talk about there. I want to go to the second story. It starts in chapter 2. This is the story of the turning the water into wine. And again, I'm hauling through this stuff. I have a purpose for that. I hope it will become clear at the end. Chapter 2, verse 1. And on the third day there was a wedding in Cana of Galilee, and the mother of Jesus was there, and Jesus also was invited, along with his disciples, to the wedding. And when the wine gave out, the mother of Jesus said to him, "They have no wine." And Jesus said to her, "Woman, why are you telling me this? My hour has not yet come." His mother said to the servants, "Whatever he says to you, do it." Now there were 6 stone water pots set there for the Jewish custom of purification, containing 20 or 30 gallons each. Jesus said to them, "Fill the water pots with water." And they filled them up to the brim. And he said to them, "Draw some out now and take it to the head steward." And they took it to him. And when the head steward tasted the water, which had become wine, and did not know where it came from, but the servants who had drawn the water knew, the head steward called the bridegroom and said to him, "Every man serves the good wine first, and after men have drunk freely, then he serves that which is poorer. You have kept the good wine until now." This beginning of his signs Jesus did in Cana of Galilee and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him. Okay. So, he's a guest at a wedding. In this culture, this is a catastrophic event. This is a terrible thing. I mean, for the bridegroom, the host of this feast, I don't have any more wine to give the guests. This is a shameful thing. So, Mary sees there's a problem, and she comes to Jesus. Now, when Mary tells Jesus that the wine has run out, he makes a very cryptic statement to her that we want to talk about for a second. New American Standard has it, "Woman, what do I have to do with you? My hour has not yet come." Jesus is using a very common idiom here. Literally, the idiom is, "What is to me and to you?" That's the phrase, "What is to me and to you?" I wish that the translations would bring out the meaning of this idiom more. It's not hard to see what it means. It's used in a number of places in the Old Testament, a couple times in the New Testament, and I think the sense of it is pretty clear. But it isn't clear to us the way they have translated it. This idiom means something like, why are you coming to me? In the Old Testament, we see a story like a guy is coming with his army against somebody, and he comes to them and he says, and the guy he's attacking says, what is to you and to me? That is, why are you attacking me? That guy's your enemy over there. That's the guy you have the problem with. So why are you coming to me about this? That's the import of this phrase. So I think that's what Jesus is saying to his mom. I would paraphrase what he's saying here as something like this. Why are you telling me about this? This is not my wedding, and it is not yet my time to step onto the center stage as the Messiah. When he says, my hour has not yet come, there is a time coming that will be his hour. He will manifest, he will die and be raised again, and his glory will be manifested, and ultimately he will be the center of everything. But that hour has not yet come. Right now, he's just kind of hanging in the shadows, gathering some disciples together. This is not his time yet. So I think in essence what he's getting at here is, although it is true that he's about to do a miracle, he doesn't step forward and to proclaim to everyone in the room that he is the Christ. It's not like he steps forward and says, I am the King of Israel. I am the bringer of the harvest. I am here to save your wedding. And then does this great miracle and everyone goes, oh, it's the Messiah. I mean, because it's not his hour. That's not what he has come to do yet. There is a time when he is going to manifest himself openly and will do that, but not yet. So he does a quiet little miracle, which you'll notice, in fact, only his disciples and the servants really see it happen. The guests, they have no idea what's going on with this. The head steward, the bridegroom, the guests at the wedding, none of them have any idea that this is going on. This is happening kind of in the back with the servants. And then notice how John highlights the evidence of what has happened. The disciples and the servants saw the whole thing. So, okay, yes, the guests didn't see it, but the disciples saw it. And the servants knew all about this. The head steward didn't know, but he provides an independent kind of testimony because he had no idea what was going on. He had just been told, we've run out of wine. And then the servants bring him this stuff that was in the water pot, and he drinks it, and he goes to the bridegroom and says, you know, you got this all wrong. You're supposed to give the good wine first, but you kept the good, because, I mean, you all know why this is, right? I mean, basically, people get drunk drinking the good wine, and they don't notice so much what the wine is like after that. So you save the cheap wine until people have, I kept the translation drunk freely, but it basically the word is get drunk. I mean, it says, you give the good wine, and after people get drunk, then you give them the cheap wine. That's what it says. Okay, so, but the point of his testimony here is, I mean, as a sidelight, it's good wine. Jesus' wine is better wine than the wine that they had, which is interesting and in and of itself. But fundamentally, what it says is he's not set up for anything. He doesn't know anything about a miracle or anything. He's just tasting it, and it says, this is good wine. Which is testimony that something really happened here, because that stuff started out as water. Okay. Now, we could, and it would be appropriate, to ask the question whether this particular miracle has some symbolic value. Did Jesus mean it to communicate something in this idea that the water has been turned to wine? And I think it's legitimate to ask that question, and it may very, very well be the case. Maybe it shows the Messiah as the bringer of abundance, the Lord of gladness and celebration. That's quite possible. Maybe it suggests the very biblical idea that the Messiah is, in fact, the bridegroom, and that this is a symbolic picture of providing wine for the ultimate messianic wedding feast. It's not his time yet, but here's a little foretaste of that. That's quite possible. Maybe the fact that the pots that the water was in were meant for ritual washing is intended to be a picture of the new wine in the old ritual pots symbolizing the end of the old religious system. That's quite possible as well. John's focus here, I would argue, though, is on what he explicitly says about this. Whatever we may draw, conclusions we may draw about the symbolism, which ultimately we would decide on based of our understanding of the whole teaching of the New Testament. It would reinforce other things that we have seen. John brings out the point that he wants to bring out about this. Verse 11, this beginning of his signs Jesus did in Cana of Galilee and manifested his glory, and his disciples believed in him. What's significant is that Jesus, the one that they are believing to be the Messiah, has done a profound miracle. It is a sign from God. Later in John, Jesus makes it clear that the miracles are done by God, by the Father, as testimony that Jesus is the Christ. These miracles are God's way of saying, yes, this is the one. I'm with him. Look at what I have done here for him. So each miracle is a sign from God, and the idea of signs is very important in the Gospel of John, because signs are miraculous testimony that Jesus is the Messiah. Each miracle signifies that Jesus is indeed the Christ. God is with him. Each miracle demonstrates that Jesus is the glorious King of God's kingdom. So this is an incredibly significant sign that Jesus has performed. It may have teaching value in terms of the symbolism of the wine, that's great, but what's of fundamental importance to John is it says God has performed a miracle for Jesus here that is a sign of who he is. What was the response to this sign? His disciples believed in him, it says. So these disciples who are with him, this is just a couple days later. This is the same period of time that we're talking about. In this space of time, these guys have either heard or been told about John the Baptist's testimony that this is the Messiah. They have joined up with Jesus. They may have heard, but at least Nathanael knows about the little miracle that Jesus did with him. And now they have gone to a wedding as guests, and Jesus has turned the water into wine. This is all. Now their response is, oh, we are following the right guy. This is really the Messiah. At every step, their appropriate response has been to believe that Jesus is the Messiah. Okay. Now, I know. You're going to go on now? You've got to talk about all that good wine stuff and everything? That's right. I'm going on to the third story. Starting in verse 12, chapter 2. Verse 12, chapter 2. After this, he went down to Capernaum, he and his mother and his brothers and his disciples. And there they stayed a few days. And the Passover of the Jews was at hand, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. And he found in the temple those who were selling oxen and sheep and doves, and the money changers seated. And he made a whip of cords and drove all the sheep and the oxen out of the temple. And he poured out the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables. And to those who were selling the doves, he said, take these things away. Stop making my father's house a house of merchandise. Okay, so situation we have here, Jews were required to come and make sacrifices in Jerusalem, but many Jews didn't live in Judea. They lived around the Mediterranean in various places quite a distance from Jerusalem. So at times of festivals, sometime in their life, they were supposed to come and do this. They would come to the temple to make various offerings. Well, it's hard. You're supposed to bring the animals from your flock and so on, or there are payments that you're supposed to make to the temple and so on, but it's hard to bring animals on a long trip like that. And the money that I have, you know how it is as a traveler, I have different money than you guys use and that sort of thing. So there had set up this system where they were allowed to come into Jerusalem and buy the animals that they would sacrifice. Which is fine, except basically what has happened then is that the temple system, which is supposed to be about a humble people coming before God, seeking his mercy and blessing, has basically become a way to make a living for the guys who around the temple there. Hey, we got people coming in. They need sheep. I got sheep. I can get a good price for my sheep because what are they going to do? They got to go sacrifice. So I don't know specifically all of the details of what was going on and what exactly Jesus is responding to, but clearly he's outraged by the way God's house has been trivialized, and he makes a huge scene. Okay, so my father's house, this shouldn't be happening in my father's house. Now, several other gospels picture this scene as well. John's particular emphasis, however, I think is seen in the next part, which is only in his gospel. And that's what I want to focus on here. So in 2:17, it says, his disciples remembered that it was written, zeal for your house will devour me. Okay, I used to misunderstand what this verse is saying. The typical translation is, zeal for your house will consume me. And I understood that in the sense that we often use the word consume, like he was consumed with jealousy, or I am consumed with curiosity, or something like that. The idea is, so zeal for your house will totally and passionately fill my mind, is what I understood that verse to be saying. You know, I will be totally taken up and involved passionately with my zeal for your house. That's what I thought it was saying. But when you go back and look at it in the context of Psalm 69, which I want to read a few verses of here, I think it becomes fairly clear that that's not what the verse is saying. So I want to read from a few verses in Psalm 69, starting in verse 6. Psalm 69, verse 6. May those who wait for you not be ashamed through me, O Lord God of hosts. May those who seek you not be dishonored through me, O God of Israel. Because for your sake I have borne reproach. Dishonor has covered my face. I have become estranged from my brothers and an alien to my mother's sons. For zeal for your house has devoured me, and the reproaches of those who reproach you have fallen on me. Okay. So in this context, I think David is lamenting the results that have come to him from following God. It is for your sake, God, that I have borne reproach. I am dishonored, I have become alienated from my family and so forth, and it is for your sake that this has happened. Verse 9, our verse, is an example of Hebrew parallelism. I don't know if you've heard of this concept before, but Hebrew poetry, the main feature of Hebrew poetry is that it goes in paired lines. And the two lines work together. Oftentimes, the two lines mean the same thing. My mother's son hates me, and my brother despises me, or something like that, where the two things mean basically the same thing, but you kind of put them together to get the full idea. So the two statements are, for zeal for your house has devoured me, and the reproaches of those who reproach you have fallen on me. And those two lines are meant to be taken together. So notice in the second line, the reproaches of those who reproach you have fallen on me. Notice the kind of ironic twist. There are those who reproach you, God, but their reproaches fall on me. You know, I'm following you. They don't like you, so they don't like me. They're shooting at you, but I'm the one that's getting hit. So now that, excuse me, that other line is meant to go along with that. Zeal for your house has devoured me. Excuse me. That same twist is there, I think. It is my zeal for your house that has ended up having this consequence on me. And the word is often used, it's consumed or devoured, but it's often used in the sense of consumed or devoured in the sense of destroyed. I have been consumed as in used up, beaten up, taken out, you know, that kind of thing. So I think it's clear in the context that that's the thing that he's talking about. It is zeal for your house that has ended up having this negative consequence on me. And that's what the disciples are remembering then as they're looking at this story with Jesus, as they're looking at what has just happened. They're remembering this lament that Jesus had made. Having a zeal for your house, Lord, has led to my devastation at the hands of your enemies. And their fear is that that is what will happen to Jesus. You can see why they might be thinking about this. Here he is at God's house, and he's going through and he's throwing down tables, and he's got a whip, and he's driving out the animals and all of this stuff. And they're thinking, oh, they're going to be mad about this. I mean, the leaders in the temple here, they're going to be outraged that he's doing this. We're all going to get in a lot of trouble, I think, is what they're thinking. And in fact, this act is part of what ultimately led to Jesus' crucifixion. I mean, it is true that this is a part of what turned the Jewish leadership against him, ultimately. That's very significant because that's in focus here as we go along. That's what the rest of this is really about. And so let me read the rest and then try to make some sense of it here. The Jews therefore answered and said to him, "What sign do you show to us, seeing that you do these things?" Jesus answered and said to them, "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up." The Jews therefore said, "It took 46 years to build this temple, and will you raise it up in 3 days?" But he was speaking of the temple of his body. When therefore he was raised from the dead, his disciples remembered that he said this, and they believed the scripture and the word which Jesus had spoken. Okay, funny thing. Here's the disciples believing again. So this is a very subtle and dramatic scene, I think. I used to think it was weird. I mean, in all the Gospels, but especially in the Gospel of John, Jesus, he almost always responds to whatever somebody says to him with something sort of cryptic and turning it back on them. You know, he almost never gives you the sort of answer that you expect. You know, you say, "Hey, Jesus, how's it going?" And he comes back with something about, you know, the kingdom of God or something, and go, "But I just wanted to know how it was going," you know. And now, well, I'll go into all that. I mean, the fact is that's the sort of thing that he does. And so here, he makes this statement that comes, I thought it was just kind of weird at first, but I'm getting used to the way Jesus does things, I think, and I actually have come to think that this is kind of brilliant, what it is that happens here. They're coming to him and saying, "Who do you think you are? Overturning the temples and driving out the animals and all of that stuff. You had better be able to show us a sign from God that you're somebody, that you have the right to come in here into the temple and to do a thing like this." And so Jesus says, "Okay, you want a sign? I'll give you a sign. Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up." He's looking into the eyes. At this point, I mean, I think it's fairly sure. It's not just the merchants who are around now at this point. It's the leaders in the temple and so on. They've all come to see what's going on. And they say, "Who do you think you are? What sign do you have to show us?" He's looking at them. They're angry. They're dismissive of him. And so he's basically, in a metaphor, what he says to them, he says, "Kill me, and in 3 days I will rise again." So, now remember, this is the disciples. They were remembering this verse. "Zeal for your house will destroy me." And this is exactly what they're afraid of. That, I mean, he's getting everybody angry. This is going to turn out bad. So Jesus says, "You want a sign? Kill me. and in 3 days I will rise again. And naturally, because of the metaphor, they're going to look at that and think, oh, yeah, right, so we're going to destroy the temple. So, you know, that's a safe kind of sign to say you'll give. If you destroy the temple, I'll raise it up in 3 days. But in the end, that is exactly what happened. The Jewish leaders, together with the Romans, destroyed the temple of his body, and in 3 days he raised it up. So what he said to them in this context is exactly, in fact, what ended up happening. Now, obviously, Jesus didn't expect anybody to understand what he was saying. He has a lot of courage, if you think about it. In this situation, he has gone and done this violent and disruptive thing, and they're angry and upset. And everything in me at this point would want to be kind of going, well, no, let me explain, you know, don't take it wrong, you know, but he says something that nobody there can even understand what he's saying. I said, what in the world are you talking about? And yet, his disciples remembered that he had said this. The other folks, they have no idea what it's about. And the disciples had no idea what it was about. They didn't know what he was talking about, but they remembered that he said it. And after the resurrection, they're thinking back, and they're going, oh, yeah. He said, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up. And after 3 days, he rose from the dead. He was talking about himself. And so it says that they believed the scripture and they believed his word. I'm not sure about the scripture, if it means the specific thing from the psalm, because I would argue that's not intended to be a prediction exactly. But it may be just the scriptures that they're talking about are the scriptures that would talk about his rising from the dead. Perhaps that's what they mean. But what's clear is they believed his word. They're thinking back on what he said. So yeah, he said this was happening, and that's what happened. So here is another story where we're seeing the experience of the disciples is reinforcing their confidence and belief that Jesus is who he says he is. Okay, so those are the three stories I wanted to talk about. Let me just make a point, and then I'll kind of wrap it up, and then we can have some questions and comments. The original disciples are serving as eyes and ears for you and me, for all believers. John is concerned with showing how they became convinced that Jesus is the Christ. The progress of understanding of the disciples is important in John because they're the ones who are telling us what this is all about. John is one of these disciples. He's the one who's telling us these stories. He's convinced that Jesus is the Christ. Why he's convinced is an important question. And how what they saw and how it affected them is a very important theme throughout the book. And that theme is going to get played in a variety of different ways. Here we're seeing it in a fairly simple form. It's going to get a little more Baroque as we go along. But what do we see in the story? Andrew, Peter, Philip, and Nathaniel, and an unnamed disciple, came to believe through the testimony of John the Baptist and through Jesus' miraculous knowledge of Nathanael, even though he wasn't there. So John the Baptist and this small miracle, those things have brought these men to an initial acceptance of the idea that Jesus is the Messiah. A few days later, these disciples all see Jesus turn the water into wine. This is a sign, a major miracle done by God to signify that Jesus is the Messiah. And again, it says they believed. Their response is, yeah, we were right. We were thinking he's the Messiah, and we're convinced again. And then finally, and this is not right at the same period of time, but we have this story about how in the casting out of the money changers, Jesus said that he would perform a sign. If the Jewish leaders destroyed this temple, by which he meant the temple of his body, he would raise it up. And after the resurrection, the disciples remember what he said, finally realize what he was getting at, and have all the more belief and confidence in what it is that Jesus said and who he was. So the disciples had testimony from John the Baptist about what God had done with him to show that Jesus is the Christ, and they had seen several miracles themselves. That's why they believed, and that's why they testify to us that Jesus is the Christ. That's why John is reporting to us, he is the Christ, and these are the reasons we have for thinking so. Now, we also have our first taste of what kind of man Jesus is, what kind of Messiah they are believing in. He invites the disciples to follow him as their rabbi. He unashamedly says, follow me. Come and learn from me. He takes it upon himself to rename Simon as Peter. We're never told what he thought of that. I mean, like, oh, that's cool, or what? You're giving me a new name? But he meets him and says, I'm giving you a new name. He claims that they will see the angels of God ascending and descending upon him. He implies that one day his hour will come. It's not yet, but it will come, that hour when he's glorified as the Messiah. And he audaciously takes it upon himself to defend the purity of his father's house by violently disrupting the merchants in the temple. This is the picture we see so far of this man whom the disciples are coming to believe is the Messiah. This is their testimony to us. This is how he acted, and these are the miraculous signs that we saw, they're saying. And John's telling us these things because we have to decide for ourselves whether we will believe their testimony. That's what the Gospel of John is all about. It's about telling us what happened so that we can decide what we're going to do about it. They decided that he's the Messiah. What are you going to decide? That's ultimately what the gospel is doing, I think. Okay, so those are my three stories. Lots of questions we could have. Robbie, let's start with you. Robbie, up here.
I had two little thoughts.
Okay.
The first one's a little one, but the naming of Peter as the rock.
Mm-hmm.
Since later on in Peter's mm-hmm. life, we see he's more like jello, that I wonder if it was for Peter's sake in a way. That's just a side comment.
Okay. Okay.
And the other thing is what Jesus, I mean, when Jesus says that if you destroy this temple, mm-hmm. I mean, it seems that there has to be, nobody understood what he was saying, but they thought he meant the temple that he
right.
was seeing, which is the place where God is, a sanctuary of God.
Right. Yes.
So, if you wanted to comment on why he would then, I mean, he was turning it around, and in a sense, it's the temple of his body, but he's the true temple.
Right.
So.
Okay, so let me comment on both of your little statements. First of all, the thing about Peter, it is true that Peter has kind of a wild ride as he goes along, but remember, there is a central event, and it's interesting to think about this because John is portraying that these early disciples, they have been confronted with the claim that Jesus is the Messiah right from the beginning. And they're believing that that's the case. Okay? But Jesus is kind of, I don't think Jesus is going along every day and saying, yeah, that's right, I'm the Messiah. I mean, they're sort of in this spot where they're following along with him, trying to figure out where he's coming from. And remember, John the Baptist has given this glowing testimony. This is what I saw from God. But remember that John the Baptist, later in his life, when he's in jail, I may have mentioned this last time, but he hears the story about Jesus and what he's doing, and he is so unlike what John the Baptist expected that he sends a messenger to him saying, are you the one? Or are we waiting for someone else? I mean, he's confused. Okay, so why am I saying all this? There comes this place in Jesus' ministry where he asks the question, who do men say that I am, of his disciples? And they say, well, some say you're Elijah, and some say you're John the Baptist. Come back, you know. And then he says, who do you say that I am? And Peter responds, you're the Christ. You're the Messiah. You're the Son of God. And Jesus says to him, flesh and blood didn't reveal this to you, but my Father. And I say to you that your name is Peter, because I named you that earlier, and on this rock I will build my church. Okay, so I think it's at least partly the name is also, I mean, it may be for his benefit, but it actually points to something. It is Peter's ultimately supernaturally endowed confident belief that Jesus is the Messiah. It is that faith, the faith passed on by the apostles, that is ultimately going to be the rock upon which Jesus builds. So there is at least that significance to the name rock, is that in the sense Peter really is, as an apostle and as kind of the leader of the apostles, he is this rock, he is this foundation upon which Jesus is going to build. So there is an appropriateness to it that way as well. I know what you're saying. He definitely has a lot of fears along the way, and so there is a kind of an irony in calling him the rock when he's the one that denied Jesus and he has a number of problems along the way. But he is also rightly, I think, celebrated as there is a core stability, strength in him that is rooted in this faith that God is building in him, I would say. So it is interesting to think about that, because we see them here right away believing that Jesus is the Messiah, but I think the disciples are going to kind of go up and down as they go along. They understand the idea that he's the Messiah, but then he does things that they don't understand, and all along, it isn't really until the end that they really kind of get to the spot, okay, I get what this is about. And then the second thing you said, I should have mentioned that. I think that's right about the temple. It's something very appropriate about referring to himself as this temple, because of this place where God dwells. That's true. The New Testament refers to the church as the temple of God also, God dwelling in us as with Christ at the head. And also sometimes we as believers are referred to as a temple because of the idea of the Spirit of God dwelling in us. All that language, I think, related, as you're saying, to the idea that God is actually in this person or this thing or this group or in some way. And obviously God is in Jesus in a unique way. So, sure.
Could you comment on how Jesus's mom handles what he says to her? Because it sounds like he's saying, you know, go away. And it sounds like kind of behind his back, she goes, and she does say, well, whatever he does, you do it. It's like she has this other knowledge. And it's very intriguing. So can you shed some light on that?
See, partly what I'm saying about that idiom is I don't think it's as dismissive as it sounds in our translations. That is, what he's saying to her, I mean, it is, this is another one of his cryptic coming back at you in a different way than you were expecting kind of statements. I mean, it's kind of making her think about, well, what were you expecting here? But I think what he says to her is, I mean, it is kind of surprising if you think about it. They've run out of wine. It's the bridegroom's responsibility to be the host of this thing. So she comes to him, and what he says to her is, as I understand it, is, why are you coming to me? That is, what are you expecting? What would make you think that I'm the one to come to about this? Now, obviously, as it turns out, it's not that he is unprepared to do something, but I think he's challenging her to ask the question, what do you think this is all about? What are you expecting in this stuff? So I don't take it as dismissive, but it's not, this is not a son talking to a mother. This is the Christ talking to one of his disciples, basically. I mean, he's, what he's saying to her is the way he would do with any of the disciples, is he sort of, he takes her question and he brings it up short and says, well, wait a minute, let's think about this. What are you getting at? And so then her response, it's true, it is interesting. She doesn't go to the servants and say, well, never mind, he's not going to do anything. I mean, but I take her response to indicate that she really does, I mean, she knows who he is. I mean, she has every reason, if anybody would know who he is, she ought to know who he is. So, okay, he said, my hour has not yet come. I'm not, this is not the time for me to big public revelation as the Messiah or anything. But she still has confidence that he could do something if he wants to. I mean, okay, so maybe we're not going for the big all-out full tilt public display thing, but this is Jesus, this is Messiah. So I think she's saying to the servants, basically, you just be prepared to do whatever it is he might want you to do. That's the best. The thing is, the whole thing is cryptic. It's an unusual sentence that he says to her, and we don't really have explained what her thinking was or anything. That's how I would put it together. But like I say, I think it was not a dismissive, see that, what do I have to do with you? That sounds like, ooh, what would make you think that I would do something for you? I mean, or something like that, which sounds bad, but that's not what the phrase means. It means, why are you coming to me about this? Which implies, at this wedding, aren't there people that would be more appropriate to talk to about this than me? I mean, why have you come to me? But that question, why have you come to me, is not go talk to the bridegroom. I think it's one of those provoking sort of, think about it. What were you expecting me to do here? How do you picture what I'm doing and how I'm about stuff here? So, I don't think it's quite as harsh as it sounds, but it is definitely one of his, oh, I wasn't expecting that answer kind of answers. I mean, which is almost, in John, almost every one of his answers is, oh, I wasn't expecting that answer kind of answer. In fact, so much so that I've said this many times before, but it's in John at the end in the upper room where Jesus says something and they say, wow, you're talking to us straight without a figure of speech. I mean, it was so unusual for him to just say it out directly what it is he's talking about that they comment on it. Wow, this is amazing. You're actually saying something here. So,
well, also maybe as his mom, she knew him as a person of tremendous compassion.
Right.
So I don't know. I mean, why else would she have not been, you know, maybe completely taken aback by that? You've explained, I'm not talking about the first part, I'm talking about if he's saying, my hour's not yet come, why wouldn't she just go away?
Right.
Why would she still hang out and go, but, you know, this is Jesus, you know?
Mm-hmm. Right. No, exactly, and that is the tension there. And like I say, the best, I think you're right to point to her knowledge of his character. All that he has really said is, this is not my hour. Okay, so that means certain kind of things are not going to happen. But still, I know who he is, so that doesn't rule out that he might not do something. So
I think it's great.
Yeah.
Thank you, Ron.
Sure.
Very good. Two comments. One is, I read that Simon means hearing. Mm-hmm. So interesting that a rock does no hearing. Mm-hmm. Secondly, I've just read a book that culminates in these passages. It's Anne Rice's book, Christ the Lord, Road to Cana.
Right.
So I thought it was a fantastic book. I'd be very interested if other people have read it and hearing your comments, yours or theirs sometime. Right. That's it. Thanks.
That was really very interesting. And I love the big picture approach, or at least sometimes. I'm comforted by these mere humans like me who these signs would confirm belief. And I'm reminded that often, say in the Psalms, we're talked about remember when God did this, remember that this happened, and that right. In effect, we actually need those, or that in God's compassion, we are given those things at times. Right. They're not necessarily good, rigorous reasons to believe. So my question is, as we walk forward, well, or either come to faith or walk forward in faith, how is it that we read God? You know, we say, oh, that was a sign, therefore I'm going to accept this job, or I'm going to buy this, or, you know, I think on the one hand, we're told in these passages that these signs are real, and they're little things that could be read another way, and yet we interpret them as signs. I'm thinking of an example once when I was watching a PBS program on the Mormons, and they were giving this description of why they believed, and I thought, oh my gosh, this sounds exactly like any Christian. They have this story, this testimony, and they believe. So reading signs.
There's a lot to that, I think. I really like your question, and everything you said, there's one thing that you said, I think I wouldn't quite put it that way, which is kind of part of my answer, and that is when we look at the signs in the New Testament that are identified as signs, I don't think they're those little kinds of things. I mean, that is, it's the kind of thing where I'm something amazingly miraculous that I can't explain any other way has happened, and I'm confronted with it. Later in John, we see, you know, the guy is healed, and the Pharisees are saying to him, you deny that guy's the Christ, because that, I mean, you don't know what you're talking about, and he doesn't know what he's talking about. And they say, well, he says to them, well, you know, I don't really know what to tell you. What I can tell you is this was the blind man. I was blind, and now I see. I think is what he says, or I was lame and now I walk. I can't remember now what the particular miracle was. And there, it's kind of like, you've seen me. I've been around here. I haven't been able to walk my whole life or see or whatever, whichever it was. And now I can. So deal with it. You don't like him, but that's... So I do think that there is a different kind of phenomenon that God deals with us individually. I very much believe that I call out to God and something happens that I see and understand as the mercy of God coming into my life. I couldn't call it a sign in that sense. I couldn't go to you and say, you ought to be a believer because I prayed for this and I got it. I mean, because life's too complicated for that sort of thing, you know. But given the testimony of the apostles and the other reasons I have for believing in my life and dealing with God, I believe that really was God responding to me because I have good reason to believe that God is there and good reason to believe in his mercy, and this is how he has dealt with me. So in that sense, I agree with that, trying to read the events of my life and ask, how is God dealing with me? I think that's right.
So in part, it's context over time, knowing God over time, but also maybe that there is a we could probably read something another way because we want that to be the answer.
Yes.
And that we all have to continually be careful about that.
Oh,
and
absolutely.
That it's that there is a difference between serendipity or a coincidence versus something that is, if I can use the word, customized.
We can
pervert that if we want to.
Right. Yeah. And the fact is, the problem, my hesitancy about the whole signs in my own life thing is, if I turn it into an expectation, this is how God is going to deal with me, then I'm sort of putting God in a position, okay, God, I'm ready to go. Where's my sign? and I'm going to find it, and I'm going to make it work. Whereas what I'm talking about is God in his own time and in his own discretion dealing with me in a particular way, and I can look at it and over time and say, yes, that was God doing this thing. There is a problem of potential presumption, and also, as you say, our own desires can lead us astray so easily. And unfortunately, I see this happen all the time, is, oh, God's telling me to do this, and, you know, don't you think it might be worth stopping and thinking about what a nice coincidence it is that God is telling you to do what you want to do? Couldn't we just stop and look at least think about the fact that there are all of these other reasons why you shouldn't do this? Maybe those are significant in this context. So, yeah, I agree.
So,
yes.
So looking at the place in John where the disciples say, yeah, now you're talking to us plainly. It says, they say that, now you're speaking plainly, not in any figure of speech. And then Jesus responds, do you now believe? The hour is coming, indeed it has come, when you will be scattered, each one to his home, and you will leave me alone. And I find it interesting that, keeping with the context of belief here, I mean, those three stories you gave, each one concludes with the conclusion, you know, and then they believed in him. Well, if you think about belief as, well, you mentioned the simile of, you know, casting a vote, you know, I vote, he's the Messiah, yes. Mm-hmm. If you think of belief that way, then that whole paradigm doesn't make sense. I mean, how can you believe more than once, you know? And this is the way that people sometimes think about it, you know, and do you believe in Jesus? Yes or no? It's a simple question, right? You know, I mean, did you vote for him or not? And that's a one-time event. If you vote for a political candidate, you know, you can vote for, you know, Kucinich and then change your mind afterwards and say, I shouldn't have voted for him. And then you don't believe in him anymore. At the time you did, and that's why you voted. But the fact that they continually have their belief expanded or renewed or made more comprehensive, I think is significant, because Nathanael responds initially with a confession, complete confession. You're the Son of God. You're the Messiah. You're the King of Israel. Okay, well, that's nice. That's good that you said that. But there's more to it than that, because you don't know what the Son of God is. You don't know what the Messiah is yet. Right. And when you find out, then we'll see whether or not you believe.
Right, right. Yeah, no, I agree with that. I'm not ashamed. I don't take back the vote analogy because I would say it the way you said it. Things can come along and make me change my mind and make me change my vote. So I think the continual vote that yes, you are the Christ, as I come to understand what that means and who you are and what you're asking of me and what it may cost me and all of that. That continuity in belief indicates that there is something substantial going on there. So, I absolutely agree with that. That's exactly why it is significant that they keep believing, because they're going to learn more and more about what he's asking, what he's about, and what it's going to mean to them. And to go through that and say, yeah, I'm still on the team is very significant. I like that. Dave, did you want to, or does somebody have the mic? Who has the mic? Oh, you saw the mic. Well, let's go back to Dave. He had his hand up, and I guess we should stop with that because we're over time. Well, we'll do one more.
Just back on the science things real quickly. Part of, in terms of impact on us, is it seems to me also that those of us who understand the Bible to teach that God is intimately involved with every event and circumstance, it seems to me that would come into play as well. Sometimes I think with regards to signs about something serendipitous or unexpected or whatever, there's almost at times with some people, I think, an unspoken assumption that somehow God is more involved in this thing than everything else. Whereas it seems as though, at least as I understand the scriptures, God's involved intimately in everything that happens, and that's a good thing, and we take great hope in that. We still need to sort of not sort of, we still need to make our choices and decisions and what we're going to become convinced of and all kind of stuff, but recognizing that God is behind all of it for our benefit, and as opposed to sometimes he is and sometimes he isn't actively involved in the affairs of our lives. At least it seemed that way to me.
Yeah, no, that's right, and that's good. Let me add, though, the problem is a problem of interpretation.
Absolutely.
That is, God, as the one who is telling this story, so in the story that he's telling, there are bad people. So does that mean God is bad, or God approves of bad people? Or, I mean, you know, there's a simple and obvious thing, but one thing that is different about the sign is that it is put together in such a way that we can look at it and have confidence. I know what God is doing and saying in being behind this. I'm not sure that I know what God is saying in the fact that I have cancer or something like that.
Oh, absolutely.
But I know what God is saying in the fact that Jesus turned the water into wine. And there may be those times in my life where I feel, and can rightly feel, I look at what has happened in my life and I think I know what God is saying. You know, I'm interpreting what's happening there and I think I'm right about that. And that's where the rub comes in. He's behind everything in my life, but most of the stuff in my life that he's behind, I don't know what it means.
Sure,
but every now and again, maybe I do. Okay, great, thanks. Okay, thanks.